Good evening, I'm John Williams, I'm the creator of Scanners Night, and I'm just going to kick off by talking a bit about what a scanner is. First of all, welcome, thanks for coming out to Clark and Well and making your way to the basement, making your way all the way along Hatton Garden. I almost got lost myself. So I always want to explain for people who haven't been here before what a scanner is. A scanner, there's lots of different thoughts on this. I guess I would describe a scanner as somebody who's creative, wants to do a variety of different things, likes to start things and not always finish them, isn't always very good at follow through. They love to do things that seemingly are completely unrelated. And I've been thinking about this and what it means to me, and I reckon that I realised that my career goal ultimately was to play all day and get paid. And what I mean by that is to just get up in the morning and do whatever I feel like doing, any creative project I feel like, and run multiple things at the same time, and preferably have other people do some of the follow through, and still make good money out of it. Who relates to that and wants to play all day and get paid? Is it just me, or is it? Okay, good. So it's not just me. Hopefully, I've just heard from a publisher, I might be writing a book on exactly that topic, so I'll be talking a bit later about that, and maybe people can help me get the content for the book. So we better crack on, because we've got three speakers tonight. The theme is how to turn you... UK?
Wish and obstacle.
Yeah, no, not just yet. Okay. I think I'll do that at the end.
Okay.
We're going to talk about the second half, the wish obstacle brainstorming. So tonight's about turning a wild idea into reality, whether it's a book or a business you want to create or it's a record you want to produce. We've got people tonight, three organisations, who have done something very unique, very unusual, and turned it into both a business and a lifestyle. So if that's something you want to do, even if it's nothing to do with food, by coincidence all our people tonight are foodies, then I think you're going to find it very informative. And we'll also be in the second half talking to you, helping you with your particular idea, and giving you some help on anything you might be stuck on and making your project happen. The first persons we're going to hear from tonight are Sam Bompas and Harry Parr. Harry Parr? Yes. Is that right? Okay. And Sam and Harry have a really unusual business. Their business is somewhere between architecture and food, and I'm not even going to try and explain what it is. I'm going to let them. Please welcome Sam and Harry.
Hello. I'm Sam Bompas. This is Harry.
Can you hear me? We can do a load of shouting. It's fine.
They're good at projecting.
Well, thank you very much for having us down here. I had a bit of a mare coming here and just totally didn't bring any jellies, which was just useless, because that's what we do, we make jellies. But what we said is we want everyone to be able to have the jellies, so we're just trying to get the jellies out there. So if we'll sort of let everyone know our address of our studio at the end, and if people want to swing by, they're very, very welcome to do so. They can just drop us a line. No, the day before, and we'll have some jellies ready for people to try. But anyway, we're from a company called Bombs and Parr, which we set up almost 2 years ago. And it just started off, we were both in, well, I was working, Harry was in training to be an architect. And we wanted to do something that's fun with food. We live quite close to Borough Market, so something fun in Borough Market. We looked around all the stalls. The thing that we saw they didn't have was any light desserts. We thought, let's put a jelly in there. That's just what they need. Phoned up Borough Market and said, we've got this great idea. We want to do some jellies at Borough Market. It'd be really classy. They just told us to piss off straight away. Which is a minor setback, but at that stage we had branding, we had website set up, which were just done in really sort of, literally we drew the letters of our brand and then just put some stuff up on the internet. But it didn't matter, we had all that stuff. And so we got a few sort of weird and wonderful commissions just to go along and give jelly away at places. One of them happened to be the Innocent Village Fates VNP area. which is the IP area, and there was a journalist there, and it was literally just us sort of standing around with plates and jellies and Tupperware. It was pretty rude stuff. It's quite good quality jellies, it's fresh fruit, but it was, yeah, it's Tupperware, wasn't anything interesting. The journalist said, "God, you're doing jellies, that's brilliant. Let's write about it." And there's a very, very tiny article at the back of the Sunday Times Star magazine, which said jellies are coming back as per these people. Look at their website, which was like a hand-drawn picture by one of us. Get in touch, and so that's and from the back of that, it just all kicked off. And we got some quite strange phone calls off the back of that as well.
Phone calls was that Sam took was Warwick Castle asking to make the castle out of jelly and to make this absolutely giant castle jelly. The problem was that at the time, although we promised that we could make these bespoke moulds, we didn't really know how to do it. So Sam very tactfully and somehow very, very strangely decided that what they really wanted was a 12-course Victorian breakfast and not this giant jelly. And even more amazingly, they decided to commission this breakfast. So we went from not really knowing how to make jelly to being commissioned to do an elaborate 12-course feast. And we had pitched in the food that they served to Queen Victoria when she was at the castle. So we thought, well, how are we going to do this and pull it all together? And at the time, I was trained to become an architect, so I thought the only way to do it is just to plan meticulously. So we went down into the utmost detail about how everything's going to be served. So we ended up doing choreography for all the serving staff so that every part of the meal could be served at exactly the right time.
It's like dance moves to put the place on the table.
And then there were the tables themselves had to be relaid 4 times during the meal, so there were thousands of pieces of cutlery, so we had to work out how they were going to suddenly appear on the table in the right place. So we came back to doing lots of drawings, and then instructed our friends, who we dressed up as Victorian servants, butlers and so forth, that as long as they followed exactly what was on this little drawing that they had, then everything would be fine. And it all worked out really well at the end, and that was how we got into the idea that performance and food was something that went really well together, and the space and setting were just as important as what was on the plate.
And also probably the idea that we could probably pitch just about anything and work out quite quickly or try and work out afterwards how we're going to do it, and normally, make it work by the time it all happened.
So the next problem we had was that we really did need to work out how to make these models. So in order to do that, we decided that because the London Festival of Architecture was coming up in the summer, that the only way to do it and to force ourselves to do it would be to invite all the world's leading architects to design jellies, and we had offered to make the models. So we set about putting this competition together to promote what we were going to call a jelly banquet, and we didn't really know what it was going to be then. We just had an idea that in 4 months' time we were going to do this amazing jelly banquet, and it was going to be everything jelly.
So then we put a list together of like who would we want on a judging panel, who would be the ultimate jelly expert from the world of architecture and design, and then just went around sort of haranguing them, which is literally just trawling through the internet to draw out a phone number or an email address and just bash yourself off to it. I think I send emails to pretty much every single MP. And a lot of journalists as well. We ended up getting sort of people from the lead design Quango, people from the lead journalists from the Standard and design press. But anyway, so once we had that, we were able to push it out to architects. We invited all the architects to contribute their drawings, and somehow miraculously we got all the big names in, all the big names in the country, designed jellies, which were then able to take and present at this great big sort of jelly banquet. We had good enough images at the time that there was just incredible press for it. So we managed to flog 2,000 tickets and did a jelly feast for 2,000 people. Which also sort of got Heston Blumenthal came along to as well, just literally through me going on to a lecture where he was speaking, putting up my hand and saying, would you like to come to my party? but he came on and filmed it. It was on his channel, his feast program the other day. And that just really sort of kick-started the whole thing. It was just the most wonderful calling card you could have had. After that, because it had been written about a lot of people knew, you know, he said, oh, we did this, and people go, oh, I recognise that. Because we're on the CIA programme, BBC National News, then across all the newspapers as well. It then meant that since then we've had that's just given us our base of sort of business where we just get a constant flow of people asking for bespoke commissioned jellies. At which point Harry sort of finished his architecture training. I quit my job because it's just far too much trying to do it all at the same time. And we took it from there.
So back to the mould. What we worked out that we could do was...
Got 2 minutes.
Okay. It doesn't cost that. By drawing models on the computer and then doing various forms of rapid prototyping, you could start to make these really complex models. So I'll just pass this around. This one was one we did for the peasant blooming tool. And this is one of our first copper models that we made.
This is what we have. Ones like we wanted to do, but can afford, because the collectors sometimes basically collect the antique ones and pay loads of money for them, which is great to use them. So the business has just sort of expanded since then, and now we do a lot of making moulds. We do moulds right the way across the board, so it's not only making sort of copper moulds for jellies, we make moulds of all sorts of commodities, so chocolates, cakes, ice. If you start looking at food, a lot of it does come in moulds. I don't really think about it like that, but you can get quite into it. But then we've also been able to use the company as just a vehicle for doing things that we really enjoy. We had stuff that's a bit foody and a bit fun, and we'll just be like, right, okay, let's just do that and get it off the ground. We've got the whole sort of basis, the whole system set up to do it. So it's just the opportunity to do things that just get a bit obsessed by. So I've always been really interested in scratch and sniff. So cool. Anyway, for Valentine's Day this year, we thought we'd do a scratch and sniff cinema event. And it's happened once before in the 1980s, 1981. But I was actually born when they had the scratch and sniff event.
Yeah, I remember the one.
And so we thought we'd do a cinematic scratch and sniff event, but we'll do all sorts of different perfumes. And I don't know if you know the film Peter Greenaway is the cook with his wife and her lover. But there's some fairly sort of poignant moments in that where the embattled couple are forced into the back of a rotten meat locker. We managed to have a pretty great fun event with this. We managed to just get Peter Greenaway to introduce it as well, which was incredible because he's sort of famous for first, my favourite director. But we do a lot of events like this where we'll literally have an idea, it'll be sort of food related, quite fun, and we'll just knock it out. And we're now doing this sort of style catering, so people, rather than getting us to do canapes, will get us to turn a posh art gallery into a sort of pizzeria, doing really dirty pizzas, and we'll brand the gallery up as a pizzeria, and it'll just be quite fun. And we've got another event coming up as well, which is great for everyone to come to, where we're vaporising a load of gin and tonic, turning it into a solid cocktail cloud. Anthony Gormley's Blind Light, but just instead of using water, using G&T. If you're in there for 40 minutes, you have the equivalent of one drink. It probably costs about a month cocktail. It should be a lot of fun. But all the details are on the website, which you're going to have a look at to see where we're based, so you can swim by for a jet later on.
Tell us the website.
www.jellymongers.co.uk.
Thank you.
One question. So we'll just take a couple of questions. One thing I want to ask is, what there's a kind of, is it a question? There's a theme, I think, of just blagging your way through, which seems to be really important. Is that fair to say? But just saying yes, you can do it, and then working out how.
Well, I wouldn't say it's blagging. That's a good thing. You've got some of the skills in the right sort of area that means you should be able to work out how to do it. But you know, it's just actually not holding back and saying, God, I don't know anything now.
Yeah.
It's just realising that if you put the hours in, you're going to be able to speak to the right person that knows it.
You can always find people that know more than you. Right. So that's what you have to do.
Good too. Who else would like to ask a question?
It's really interesting to hear your story, but it's also a little bit hair-raising. I wonder if it couldn't have gone the other way, and you could have just then stopped screwing the whole thing up.
Isn't any risk like that, though? I mean, if you've got passion, which you guys clearly have, surely that's three-quarters of the problem being.
I think we were quite lucky because Jelly was such an amazing media that really brought people together and everyone liked it. Which was really on our side, so we've always had that on our side.
Yeah, I suppose my question is, okay, so when you've got nothing to lose, you're starting out, you've got nothing to lose, and so you can have great fun blagging and winging it. Now you've had a degree of success, are you more aware of the sort of risks of winging it?
No, we just make sure that we do it even better than we've done it before. So.
Well, and for example, with this breathable cocktail, and there are massive risks with it, because if you speaking with the people who were getting the hydration units from, they did it once where they just put a bottle of wine in the humidifier that we're using, and it got a room full of this many people on the floor in 4 minutes flat. So if you're then putting spirits into it, you're on the risk of doing something really pretty damaging to people. And also if you're vaporizing spirits as well, it becomes very, very flammable, so you might blow up. So I think before we might have just said, sod it, we'll work it out, we'll do a bit of testing on ourselves beforehand, we'll be okay. Now it's even more fun, because we've gone to a world's leading chemical explosives expert, said, look, we can't pay you anything, this might be a bit of fun, we can give you some tickets. How much alcohol can you vaporize before it becomes an explosive risk? And the same thing, we're speaking to some extreme doctors that specialise in deep sea diving, space and high mountain exploration to check out absorption rates so people absorb the right amount of alcohol. So it's actually, it's good fun as well.
I think they're holding there actually, but I just think that's absolutely wonderful. Can you thank? Okay, we're going to crack on. I just love what they're doing. It's completely mad, and I love it. Okay, so the next person we've got is Petra Barron from Chocstar, and she's going to tell you all about her UK chocolate tour that she's done or still in the middle of.
Done,
and her plans for something even grander. Welcome, Petra. Oh, yes, she has chocolate. So, Petra, these are Petra's own chocolate brownie bites we're going to pass around.
If you don't like chocolate,
I don't have to have a microphone, do I?
No, you don't. Can you project?
I'll try and project. I've got a bit of a cold, so let me know if you can't hear me. Do you like brownies? Excellent. So I've got a chocolate van. It's called Chocstar, but I've nicknamed it Jimmy because I got it from Scotland, from Inverness. On eBay. I bought it on eBay 3.5 years ago. I'll just explain how I came to buy a van and turn it into a chocolate mobile. I'm a scammer, like everyone here, I guess. And my main things in life have always been love of travel and love of new people and love of food. And I've been kind of searching my whole life for a way of turning this into something that pays and gets me up in the morning and gets makes me a living and makes me a life as much as a living a life. So I've tried loads of different things. I went to university and finished university and I thought, okay, I'm going to become a casting director. And I worked for some casting directors in London looking for people for parts in TV commercials and pop videos, and I used to have to go up to strangers in the street and say, hey, you'd be great for this part and stuff like that, and I loved it, but I had itchy feet. I just wanted to get out there and explore the world, and so I decided I was going to run away to sea. And I ran off and worked on super yachts and worked all over the world, looking after very rich people, making them cocktails and making their beds and serving them dinner and everything like that. And that was fantastic, but it was kind of not right either. It was a bit kind of controlled, there were so many rules. It was a bit like being in a really strict school. And we were always getting into trouble. And it was really fun, but it was a bit controlled. But while I was away, I always used to be drawn to chocolate shops everywhere I went, whether I was in America or Spain or France or Israel. I was always hanging out in chocolate shops, looking at what everyone else is doing. And eventually I decided, right, enough's enough. I've got to stop working on boats. I'm going to become one of these kind of haggard old stewardesses that's 45 and doesn't really kind of know what else to do with themselves and drunk too much and had too much time at sea. So I decided to go back to London with this idea that I wanted to work with food, specifically chocolate, and it needed to be something that allowed me to keep on moving. So even if I was going back to Britain, I thought, right, I need something that's going to keep me moving and not just stuck in an office. And I don't really even remember when I had the idea. I just, one day I had this idea that I was going to set up a chocolate business. I looked around at everyone else. This was 2004, so it was kind of like the beginnings of the rumblings of chocolate becoming something more in this country than the typical Cadbury's scenario. Green and Blacks was already up and running, but there wasn't really this whole dedication to single origin and estate and speciality chocolate. It was kind of starting to happen, and I'd been living in Barcelona where they were doing incredible things with chocolate. I'd been in Israel where they were doing incredible things with chocolate. Even like America, I'd be off in the soda fountains kind of having these incredible milkshakes and delicious desserts, and I kind of thought, God, it's so fun and it's so interesting. And in Britain it just felt a bit kind of twee. There was chocolate shops with little doilies and cute little kind of things, or then there was a real French style chocolate shops which always seemed a bit standoffish and scary, and people kind of would, there was a sort of very sort of French attitude of kind of sort of slightly aloofness. And I kind of thought, well, chocolate is so much fun and it's such a fantastic thing. I want to make something that's going to be good quality but accessible and available to everybody, not just certain members of Britain. So I decided, right, I'm going to get this chocolate van. I'm going to get a van and I'm going to turn it into a chocolate van and I'm going to take it around the world. That was my impetus. And that's something I've always kind of tried to sort of keep strong to. And so I bought the van. Before I bought the van, I decided, okay, I don't know anything about chocolate. I know that I like it, just like everybody, but I don't really know anything about chocolate. So I went and got a job in a good chocolate shop called Pierre Marcolini, which was in Kensington at the time. And I learned so many different things about chocolate. I learned about where it comes from, how it's made, why it's so good for you, why people like it so much, hundreds of different things, and it was fascinating. And I felt after about 6 months, okay, I'm ready to go, I'm gonna get this van. And I trawled around on eBay and I found the van that I loved, and the sale was going to end in about 2 days time, and it was up in Inverness. And I was like, oh my God. So I rang the guy and I just trusted him, and that's kind of one thing that I've really gone with my whole time, is just gut feeling and just trust that it's going to be okay. If you feel it, then you've got to do it. And so I rang this guy and he sounded lovely. I said, look, I can't come and look at it. he said, can you send somebody? And I sent a text around to everyone I knew saying, does anyone know anyone in Inverness? Please, they've got to go and look at this band for me. And so somebody said, yeah, I know someone, they owe me a favour, I'll send them round. And they went and had a look at the van, they rang me up, said, yeah, that's fine, van looks okay. I was like, I don't really care if it looks okay or not, I'm getting it. And I bought the thing, and then I went up to Inverness, and me and my friend, we drove it back down to London, had this hilarious road trip. And there I was in London with this van, just like, oh my God, what am I doing? I had no business plan, I had no kind of strategy, no system for how I was going to do this. I was just like, oh my God, I've got this van. All I had was this really strong vision of how I wanted it to be, and that if I didn't do it, that I would regret it. So I then spent about 3 or 4 quite stressful months trying to figure out what to do. I assumed that if I had an ice cream van, chocolate van, whatever, that I'd be able to just drive it into Hyde Park, open up the hatch, and start selling my wares. I was like, why is no one else doing that? And then I realised, that I learned about this sort of ice cream mafia. I learned about the local councils, the rules, the regulations, all these kind of sort of obstacles to stopping people from doing things. And I remember the first time I took the van out, I just drove around London with my brother, just like, right, what do I do? I just pull up and sort of pulled up, put the chimes on, open up the hatch, ice cream, and people would kind of come, but it was not really the sort of way of doing it. And then I got a gig at Portobello Market, which sounds kind of great, but they put me up the wrong end of Portobello Market, which is the only place they could fit me. Up with all the sort of dodgy characters. All they wanted to buy from me was cups of tea and hot dogs, and it was all a bit sort of horrific and kind of interesting though. And then I just gradually started figuring out, okay, where's the best place to take this van to? And I started taking it to Brick Lane, which was perfect, exactly the right kind of people for that, people that love chocolate and fun things and something a bit nostalgic about an ice cream van, especially if it's been decorated in this lovely chocolatey way. And then people started hearing about it. I got a bit of press, and I learned that once you get one piece of press, other press quickly follows. I noticed that journalists all tend to copy each other, so I don't know if it's called lazy journalism or what, but it worked out for me. They all started writing about the van. I started getting bookings from people who were having weddings in the countryside, people who needed a visit to their film set for the crew who were kind of working so hard, people who were having birthday parties, all sorts of things. People that wanted something a bit different at their event. Then I started doing music festivals and food fairs and all kinds of things, and that was fantastic. But I still had this kind of like itchy feet. I was like, hang on a minute, I bought this van specifically so I can travel around with it. And I had done some travelling, I went to different places, different events, but I was like, no, I've got to have an adventure, I need an adventure. So then I decided, okay, I'm going to take it around Britain on a tour. And I drove it around Britain. I'd spent all this time in other countries and I'd never really seen my own nation, and I thought it'd be such a fantastic thing to drive my chocolate van around Britain and meet people in this way, because chocolate's a fantastic way of meeting people, because most people like it, I've discovered. And I dropped in on people for supper, and in exchange for them giving me supper, I would make them a chocolate pudding. And then I write about all the different people I met. And there's actually somebody here, Jane, who's from Leeds, near Leeds Brick House, who I went and stayed with. Lovely to see you. And I met all these amazing people, and it was all because of chocolate. And now I'm planning another trip, and it's going to be abroad. I'm thinking of putting the van on a ship and taking it to America and driving it across to California from the East Coast and seeing what the Americans think of chocolate. So that's my next plan. And basically, I would just say that being bold is the main thing that has got me to where I am, as well as a bit of ignorance. And there's nothing wrong with not knowing what you're doing. In fact, it sometimes helps, because if you knew what you were getting yourself involved with, you might end up not doing it at all. But once you're doing it, and
you're kind of on a roll. And as long as you listen to your gut, I think that you're always going to be okay. So, yeah, that's it. Does anyone have any questions?
Hi,
London's fantastic for that. It is the hub of things getting out there. You know, it's where word gets spread that's going to be kind of put out there and, you know, into the nation. It's the media. It's the sort of centre, isn't it?
The media is totally London-centric. We do a lot of events which we promote, budget for us, we promote it through just getting people to write about it. If it's outside London, it's a lot harder to get people to write about stuff.
That's something you can ask in the second half. We're going to ask exactly for that kind of problem and see if we can come up with a solution between us. Any other questions?
I used to work for the food industry representing people like Cadbury's. I'm a nutritionist, dietitian. Now, I don't know if you've come across them, but they're out there. They're called the food police.
Right.
People like the Food Standards Agency. I worked on the school meal review panel coming up with regulations for school. Do you know there's not even allowed a chocolate drop in a muffin in school food? Anything chocolatey is banned. But this is the work of the food police. I am dietitian, also a foodie, so I used to try and replace that sort of thing. But I don't know if you come across them. People say, well, will you be promoting a high-fat, sugar-calorie product like chocolate?
Okay, the problem with this country is that chocolate is, it's almost like it's perceived in two separate ways. It's perceived on one hand as something that's evil and full of rubbish and bad for kids and addictive and not something that you want to get involved with on a regular basis. And on the other hand, which is the more truthful fact, is that it's the greatest, it's the most complex foodstuff there is. It's a tropical fruit at its core. It's not fat, it's not calorific, it's not any of those things. It's a tropical fruit that somehow along the way got distorted into becoming this figure of evil, especially in this country. And it's something that's, it's quite a sort of topical debate at the moment, is chocolate as opposed to confectionery. And what people often mistake for chocolate, they're actually talking about confectionery, and they're two completely different things. And it's really exciting at the moment because there's a lot of debate about chocolate, pure chocolate, being really good for you, and for many, many different reasons. And we need to, what we need to do is be able to focus on splitting up the two and dividing them into that's candy, confectionery, that's one thing, but that's not what chocolate is.
What would jelly be?
Isn't jelly quite good for you?
Well,
I don't know about jelly. I like that.
Let's not worry too much about that. Okay, if you want to ask more, Petra's going to be around all evening, so we're going to have a break after the next speaker. Can we just thank Petra? Again, I love what she's doing. So the next thing we're going to do is go beyond chocolate. And our next speaker is Sophie Boss, who runs Beyond Chocolate with her sister Audrey. Sophie's here tonight. I've known Sophie for quite a few years. And you're going to tell us what Beyond Chocolate is. Do you want a microphone?
I'm fine with my voice. Yeah. Can you hear me all over? I'm actually not going to tell you what Beyond Chocolate is just yet.
Okay.
Because I think that's less interesting than why I created it and how it is just such a lot of fun to be my own boss and do what I love, which is what I think most of you want to do. So I was the kind of person who, even as a child, loved knowing how to do things, found out how to do them, did them for a while, got passionate, and then got bored. Knitting, sewing, photography, cooking, you know, I do it, I get really into it. And then I'd done it and wanted to do something else. And I kind of did that with my jobs as well. I left university and was recruited into Marks and Spencer's management. And I did really, really well, got to the top of it and thought, this has got to be the most boring job I've ever done, and wanted to do something different. Went and sold advertising, got really good at it. It was the late 80s, money was absolutely plentiful. I made tons of money, but got bored of that as well and wanted to do something else. So I decided, because I was a linguist, I would go and retrain as a teacher. And I became a teacher, and I absolutely adored doing that. Got pregnant and decided I wouldn't carry on teaching. Actually, I would home educate my kids because I could do that even better. So I just went on and on. Right, my son's here, 14. He only just started going to school last year. So poor thing, don't. Anyway, so the point is that I just loved doing things. I loved the excitement of a new project. I got into it. It fed me. I was on top of the world. And then 2 years in, I'd be bored because I'd done it. And what was there left to do? So,
can we just check who relates to that? that's a scam.
And the thing, you know, the problem was that I would think, sometimes, and I didn't know about scanning, and I didn't know that this was okay, because actually what I told myself is I'm never going to be happy doing anything. I'm never going to be, it doesn't even matter if I create my own business, because what am I going to be able to create that is going to keep satisfying me? And the reality was I was looking at it the wrong way round, because by having my own business, and I really relate to what you guys were saying, is that I can do whatever I like. You know, it doesn't matter what the business is, I mould my business to my next passion. So I'll tell you what Beyond Chocolate is. Beyond Chocolate is about stopping dieting. It's about ending the madness of thinking that chocolate is somehow bad for you. It's about ending having to be on a diet, not eating things, worrying about how you look. It's about actually being free to eat what you want, to feel good in your body and not worry about it all the time. 10 years ago, I was overweight. I had been on every single diet in the book. I mean, every single fad, every single mad, crazy thing, and sensible ones as well. I was constantly looking for the next fix. What was going to do it? You know, was it, you know, juicing 1 week, Weight Watchers the next week, the one with maple syrup, lemon juice and water, and cayenne pepper, God forbid. I went and bought a crate, and because I do things really well, and I get really into it, I researched it, I knew all about it, I went and bought a crate of organic lemons, a crate of organic maple syrup, cost me a bloody arm and a leg, and I lasted about a day. I mean, you try living a whole day on maple syrup, lemon juice and cayenne pepper, it was really great. Anyway, so, but the thing is, I just couldn't anymore. And one day, my sister, who would be here if she wasn't in Italy, lucky woman, one day she had similar problems on her side. She was bulimic, she'd been throwing up 3 times a day. We didn't even know that. We're 5 years apart, I never knew that she was bulimic and threw up 3 times a day. And she didn't know how much I hated my body, how faddy I was about food and how I was constantly on the next diet. We kind of didn't talk to each other about it. We competed about who's lost the most weight in a kind of nice, sisterly way, but we didn't talk about what was really going on. And she found a book by an American woman called How to Break Free from Compulsive Eating. How to Break Free from Compulsive Eating. Do you know, I looked at that title and thought, no, I'm not a compulsive eater. I don't need that. There's nothing wrong with me. I just need to get a bit more willpower. The next diet, find it, it'll fix me. But the reality is I was quite drawn to the title and I read it. And beyond all the kind of Americanisms, and I apologize if there's anyone American here today, but beyond all the Americanisms and the kind of language that I couldn't relate to, was a really, really important message, which was, we don't have to do this madness. We really, really don't. And women in particular, I know some men have issues with food, but women in particular, we don't have to spend our lives worrying about how we look and what we're putting in our mouths or not putting in our mouths, or whether we should have put it in our mouths or not, or how many calories it's got. And it just gave me a completely new perspective. I could just learn to have a normal relationship with food. Does anybody know what that is? Anyway, a normal, balanced relationship with food. I could eat when I was hungry, stop when I'd had enough, and if I was doing that, I could eat anything I wanted, which is absolutely true. I lost shed loads of weight. I've never put it back on again, but most importantly, I just feel so different. I don't think about it anymore. We invited Petra to our book launch. We wrote a book, which I'll tell you in a minute. We invited Petra to our book launch to provide chocolatinis, chocolate martinis and hot chocolate shops and all sorts of different things. We had masses of muffins and all sorts of chocolatey sandwiches. We made our own Nutella out of Valrhona, really good quality chocolate. We did that, Audrey and I did that at our book launch because we had fun. So, rewind, what's Beyond Chocolate? Beyond Chocolate is a way of stopping dieting. It's not a programme, it's not a set of rules, it's not a set of guidelines. It's just about actually giving back the power to individuals, to women, and saying you actually don't need anybody to tell you what to do. If you listen to yourself and you learn to eat when you're hungry, you can do it. It's much more complex than that, but I won't really bore you with it. The point is that 10 years ago, when I had two tiny little children, my little one I was home educating, I was at home, I decided that the world had to know about this. And there was no one in this country doing anything like this. So I phoned up, I tried to phone up Janine Roth in America, the woman who'd written this book, say, will you train me? If I come to the States, will you train me? Couldn't get a phone number. I emailed her and got this standard reply and thought, do you know what? Why am I waiting for someone else to train me? What? Who trained her? So I began to do some research, and I looked into it, and I worked on my relationship with food, and I spoke to every single woman I knew and asked her, what was her relationship with food like? And would she really spill the beans and tell me the gory details? And they did. And I decided that it must be worth setting something up. Didn't quite know what. And in the back of one of these books it said, set up a self-help group. So I made some little cards, and I put them in various places, and I got zero replies. Not a single person was interested in coming to my self-help group. And I don't really blame them because I wasn't really offering very much. So then I thought, actually I need to charge people. And that's, if I give you one tip, it's charge people, ask them for money, and give things away. Give a lot away, because these guys gave a lot away, and I've done that too. But also value yourself. You know, I wasn't valuing myself by saying I was setting up a support group, because actually, I'd done lots of work. So what I actually did was spent another year writing a course, writing a weekend course that I could run with my sister. And we rented a beautiful, beautiful country house in Gloucestershire. We had the most amazing catering, and the next best thing I did was to spend some money on PR. So at our first course, we had 8 women, 4 real women and 4 journalists. we did interview them and we checked that they were all genuinely interested, but the best thing about that was that we got an article in The Independent on Sunday, an article in The Daily Mail, an article in The Observer, and I can't remember what the other one was, but the point was that we got some publicity. Most importantly, we also got the other 4 women giving us the most amazing feedback. And we grew it from there, where we started, my sister and I, literally at her kitchen table. We called it Beyond Chocolate because it was about worrying about it. Beyond exactly what Petra was saying, making it the enemy or this amazing thing that you shouldn't really have or think of only from afar. But we could have called it Beyond Peanuts, Beyond Crisps, Beyond Mashed Potato, Beyond anything. The point was to have a name that wasn't scary and that was media attractive. The fact that we had chocolate in the name of our business means that the media just came crawling. And the fact that we invested, the little money I had at the time, I invested it in PR, still gets me PR today. We still have contacts, of course, and that was 10 years ago, because we first contacted them then. So we started Audrey and I, and we were running little courses, and we were doing bits and pieces. Today we have 15 licensees. We're about to train another 15 who will soon be ready to run courses all over the UK. We wrote a book. Where's my book?
Yeah.
We were approached. We didn't even have to go and sell our wares. In 2005, a literary agent sent me an email saying, I hope you won't find this cheeky, but I've had a look at your website, and it looks really cool, and I don't think you've written a book. Would you like to write one? And I thought, bloody hell. Don't know. But I thought, well, I'll have a go. Why not? Let's do it. And we wrote a book, and within a year it was published. It's in the top 5,000 ranked on Amazon, which for a non-celebrity, non-well-known book is really great. And we've got 78 five-star reviews. Because it makes sense. So we grew, and we created, that's 10 minutes, we created an online, what we did was actually, in 2005 I went on a course called How to Make Money Selling Workshops and Courses, or something like that. And at the time, the strapline for Beyond Chocolate was transform your relationship with food. And the woman on this course looked at me and said, you know, I don't think anybody wakes up in the morning thinking, I really must transform my relationship with food. And she was really right. I don't think anybody does. What they do is think, I've got to lose weight, or I've just got to stop this dieting madness, or I can't do this anymore. And so we started to change our wording. And actually, the strapline of the book is stop yo-yo dieting and lose weight for good, which is completely corrupts my principles. It's not about weight loss, it's not about, you know, but actually it's what people want and it gets them through the door. And that's the other thing I would say is that people are interested, what I've discovered is people are interested in what they want, not in what I do. And I can bore them senseless, telling them why what I do is so amazing and how I do it and what's so fantastic about it. And actually they just switch off. Whereas when I start to tell them what they're going to get from it, and how they can benefit from it, and tell them about all the other women who we've helped and how they've benefited from it, then they light up and they listen. So I've had to swallow my principles a bit sometimes, because I want to tell them all the really important sort of intellectual stuff, and actually they're not really interested. The other thing I said about valuing yourself is really important, because John is constantly telling me that I don't charge enough. He's probably right. But it's also really important to give things away, and not just to give things away, but I know that at the beginning I was quite precious about my idea. It was my idea, it was a really, really good idea. And I didn't want to tell anybody, just in case they went off and did it. And actually what I came to realise is that only I can do it the way I do it. And actually the more people I tell, and the more people I excite, and actually to a point, the more competition I have, the better. Because nobody is going to do it the way I do it. And that doesn't mean that somebody else won't get business. It's just that the people who want it my way and who'll be attracted by what I do will always come to me. I can't lose business by somebody else doing it. So I'd really encourage you, if you have an idea, to talk about it to everyone. The best way to get things out is to keep talking about it. And finally, I guess, for me, I'll come back to the original thing, which is the scanners, is that, do you know, I got bored running workshops. I never thought I would. I thought, because when I first... I'll never forget the first workshop I ran, and sitting with this group of women in this beautiful place, I just felt I'd come home. I thought, wow, this is what I was put on this earth to do. I love it. I didn't feel nervous. I didn't feel anxious. I didn't worry that I wouldn't know how to do it. And it's a bit like, again, these guys are saying about, and we were talking about blagging. I've never run a workshop before. I didn't have any qualifications to run a workshop. I just had a really good idea, and I knew something. I really knew it. And actually, I did it really well. But I thought, I'll never get bored. This is it. I found the one thing. And actually, it took a while, but I got bored of that too. Not occasionally, I'd still quite like to do one. But the reality is, the idea of running a workshop every single month or whatever would bore me stupid. So we decided to grow. And we took on challenges. My sister said, go on, run one for 50 people. And I'd always said, no, can't run workshops for big groups of women. It becomes really impersonal. It'd be horrible. So she challenged me to run a workshop for 50 women. That would be personal and friendly and where I'd get to know everybody. And I did that. And we did that for a couple of years. And then I got bored of that as well. So then we decided to create an online course. And I had always said, can't do this online. Absolutely not. It's got to be personal. It's got to be woman to woman. How can you possibly do this through that medium? We found a way of doing that as well, by trading what we call chocolate fairies, who are on the other end of the computer, who respond personally within 24 hours to any email, and who I've trained and I monitor to make sure they do it right. And so now we're constantly changing, and I create whatever I want. And I know, at the moment, we are looking for funding so that we can grow a bit more. And I do have a sense that one day I'll get bored of Beyond Chocolate, and I'll probably create Beyond something else. In the same kind of image of Beyond Chocolate, because that's what I love doing, is creating things and having fun and doing it in a way that I really enjoy. So that's probably said enough. If you have any questions, I'm more than happy to answer them.
Let's just have a couple of quick questions before we have a break.
Yes?
I'm really interested by the fact that you kind of think that you don't want to do something and then you sort of realize that actually you could do that, like, how, if you sort of maybe stated that you don't want to have a large group and then you do it, how you sort of deal with that? Because I think that's a really overthinking it. Like, I don't know if other people come up with it, but sort of having this sort of ideal and then realizing, well, actually, I don't know why I have that because it would be okay to do it in the
world. Well, I guess, I mean, it ties in a bit with this wish and obstacles thing, is that initially my response to everything is no. And I'm very, very privileged to work with my sister, and we work very, very well together. She has lots of ideas, and I will always say no. She'll say, oh, I thought this, like, we could do it. And I go, absolutely not. Won't work. Can't do it. No way. You know, and actually, for me, it's about realising what the obstacles are. Why am I saying no? Usually, I have a gut feeling about something that I can't possibly overcome. When I unpick it and see what the obstacles are, and I'm willing to actually deal with them, anything's possible. I mean, I don't think there's anything that we've ever considered doing that isn't possible. It's just whether I'm willing and whether I'm going to have fun doing it.
But I guess my question is more like, have you ever felt that, you know, you had maybe false, you know, loyal customers that were sort of like, I thought you, why, that sort of is goes against your ethos.
No, because, you know, we provide for everybody. And also we really listen to our clients and their feedback. And we find ways of doing things. I don't compromise on my beliefs.
Right.
I just find a way of doing things that will meet them in a way that works.
Just ask about relationships with business. It sounds very much as though you start down with what I would call lifestyle business.
Uh-huh.
You just mentioned that you're looking for funding.
Yes.
Now, funding is all about exit.
Yes.
So, have you had a fundamental shift in your own philosophy about your business as a result of going through these various changes in operations?
No, I wouldn't say we have. What we've realised is this: we can keep going the way we are, and we can grow slowly, 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 and we'll do that. That's fine. But that's pretty boring, and it's not going to get us out anywhere. Or the only way that we can grow really hugely is by having a significant amount of money, and we can't raise that. We've put in every penny that we have, and we can't raise any more. So it's not about changing. I suppose to a point I have, which is I always used to think I would never sell out, and of course I'm going to. One day, in 3-5 years' time, Mr. Weight Watchers or Mrs. Slimming World, or somebody will come along and say, I'll give you X amount for 70% of your business, and I'll probably say yes, and I don't feel I'll be selling out, because the world needs what we're doing. And if Weight Watchers carry on doing what they're doing without having what we can offer, we're just going to carry on small and we won't reach people anyway. So it's a bit like Pret a Manger, who sold 39 or 49% to McDonald's. You would have thought these guys were worlds apart. Actually, they're not. Same with Body Shop and L'Oreal. It's you know, the giants of the dieting industry who actually peddle exactly the opposite message that we do. They need this part too. And if we can provide it for them, then I'm happy to do that.
That's fantastic, Sophie. Can we just thank Sophie? I think that's brilliant. I've been making notes about everybody there. I'm learning a lot tonight. What we're going to do in the second half is we're going to help you with some of your ideas. Now, I see that our idea hat over there is groaning. If you have any, if anyone's not put their idea in there, please do. But here's what we want you to do. There's a very specific format to this. It's called a wish obstacle brainstorm. And that means you have to say what you want, the wish, your goal, whatever it is you're trying to do, and then what's stopping you right now. So don't just say, I want to have a business doing exactly what Sophie does or someone else or whatever your thing is. Also say the reason why you haven't done it so far that's stopping you, because that really gets people's brains going. It gets us thinking creatively and giving you really useful information you can use. We will coach. We're actually going to kick off in the second half with Sophie has got her own wish obstacle, which is about her funding. And Petra's got a wish obstacle as well. So we will demonstrate by using them. The other thing to say is that Sam and Harry have to get off, so you can't stay for the second half, can you? But if we can just thank all the speakers again, I think they've been fantastic.